My message this morning is entitled, What the Church Needs. Last year, Pew Research came out with a report that put some really hard data on the reality that most Protestant denominations are dying. Lots of church historians and theologians and writers were sort of wringing their hands over it or trying to show how the report didn't really signal the end of the church. Personally, I thought that those numbers were clearly a sign of the church dying, and I said publicly that I thought it might not be a bad thing. So Sojourners Magazine, probably the largest progressive Christian publication, asked me if I would write a letter to the dying church. Now, in order to lead into the rest of my message, I'd actually like to share just a little bit of that letter with you. It begins this way. To the dying church. Actually, I'm going to stop here and back up just a little. This was last year that I wrote this letter, and it was less than about 6 months after my mother died. And so you might hear a little personal stuff coming out, too, as I reflected on the decreasing attendance of church and dealing with the loss of a loved one myself. To the dying church. I hardly know what to say. Watching someone you loved, who helped raise you and cared for you when you weren't well, who partially defined who you would be, slowly perish before your eyes, is difficult to say the least. I love you. I don't want to lose you. But this is life. These things happen. Those you love do die. It's just how it works. I mean, there were churches before you. They may not have looked like you or sung songs like you or taught exactly what you do, but they all had love, just different ways of expressing it. They changed people's lives. They made some people better, and sometimes they made people worse. Then they died. In all of it, love was there somewhere, hoping to be valued, hoping to be express, hoping to be shared. Standing at the foot of your bed as you struggle to hold on, as you fight to catch a last few breaths, as you lie in the bed unaware of what is happening, it's uncomfortable and wonderful all at the same time. Remembering the twinkle in your eye from my childhood, the liveliness of your step is a beautiful and heartbreaking thing. It's as beautiful and heartbreaking a thing as I can think of in this moment. Death stinks. But there's this one thing that you taught me. It's something that I think really, truly, deeply matters. In this moment, I don't think it could matter more. Where there is God, where there is love, there are no endings. Only new beginnings. I am going to miss you so much, but I refuse to mourn you. You'll always be with me. The love that has always sought to be known is still with us. The spirit that is the church will still go on, thrive even. It will just look different and maybe sing differently and teach differently, but it will go on. The reality is that your reason for being, your very purpose is to teach us about a living God. How marvelously playful and mischievous of God, and quite frankly, how godlike of God, to figure out how to do that over and over again through a dying church. Like I said, this isn't the first time that you've died. How perfectly upside down of God to show us exactly how alive God is through a dying church. It's so belovedly human to hold on so tightly to what we know that we are constantly missing the opportunity to catch hold of something that might lead to wider fields. A very godlike God to make death the beginning of a blessing. So just know, I'm here. We are here. And you can let go. We will water the seeds. We will nurture the fields. And then we can dance in them again together. Peace, Mark. Now, I had the good fortune of that letter going somewhat viral. And as a result, I received, well, quite a bit of feedback. As you might imagine, not all of it was positive. Probably the thing that I heard the most was this: I am sick and tired of hearing that the church is dying. Well, while I was sorry that they were sick and tired of hearing it, it simply didn't change the fact that the numbers point to the reality that the church is dying. And it's important here to stop and say, when we say the church is dying, it's colloquially really just talking about that the church is increasingly losing numbers, and that folks are really just saying that the church is sinking, continuing to sink, and doesn't seem able to recapture its heydays of the previous century. The thing is this: just because we grow weary of the reality, it doesn't mean we shouldn't be confronted with it. I mean, I hate going to the doctor and being told that I'm overweight and I need to lose some pounds. I actually hate it. I'm tired of hearing about it. However, it doesn't even matter that I'm currently doing something about it. It doesn't matter that I've lost 50 pounds over the last 2 years. The fact is, I'm overweight. I can grow as weary about hearing about it as I want, but wishing that I didn't won't hear it anymore doesn't make it any less true. Just because we grow weary of a reality, it doesn't mean we shouldn't be confronted with it. As a matter of fact, being confronted with it over and over again, if necessary, is one of the things that may actually inspire us to the actions that we need to do something about it. The church is dying. There is an entire industry formed around that reality. Books and consultants and 12-step programs, all sorts of stuff that are each individually guaranteed to help you get out of the funk that the church is in. And you get some shiny new dancing shoes so that you can cut a rug with younger generations and the spiritual but not religious. The only thing is, at least in my experience, is they don't work. Some of them certainly help you feel different. Some of them help you look different. And some of them help you maybe act a bit different. But in the end, I've not seen one that works. The spiritual but not religious and the younger generations continue to dance to the beat of their own drummer while the church promenades around the same old dance floor in what amounts to nothing more than new shoes and a slightly improved sense of self-worth. That's actually the worst thing that this Save Your Church industry is doing. It's making folks in churches feel like they're doing something to impact a real change. It's allowing us to recognize that there is something wrong, and it helps us do something about it. But it lets us do it without ever having to enact substantive change. The programs all take the same old tools, they use the same old instruments, and they teach us to play the same notes with a little bit of a different syncopation. They may actually make us excited and hopeful, at least for the moment, but a year later, most churches who go through it find themselves trying out the next big idea from the Save Your Church industry, and they repeat the cycle. We do it again and again and again. One of my favorite quotes, Abraham Maslow once said, "When the only tool you have is a hammer, all problems begin to look like nails." The church doesn't need to learn how to play a new song. We need new instruments, new tools. We need innovation, collaboration, and experimentation. We need to borrow from the best minds of other institutions and ask them to apply to the church the critical thinking skills which made them successful in their own institutions. Honestly, it's a bit shameful that more churches haven't done it already. After all, some of those very people are sitting in our pews every week. What the church needs now is an innovative spirit. More importantly, what we need is the right tools for doing innovative ministry and leaders who are trained in how to use them and in how to help the rest of us do the same. And as you might imagine, that's a pretty monumental task. Some folks may think that the church would be resistant to that kind of approach, but I suppose desperate times do indeed at times require desperate measures. One seminary has actually started a Center for Innovation in Ministry. Now, I was lucky enough to be a part of their advisory committee during its first 2 years, and I have to say, I'm hesitantly excited about the concept. The Center for Innovation in Ministry sees itself as not just another think tank. It calls itself a think, do, and be tank. And it's committed to building the ability for innovation in the church, connecting those who are already innovated, and then connecting innovators with the church. If you ask me, it seems like just the thing that the church needs now. New tools. And if you're going to get new tools, why not borrow them from the very best neighbors? To prove their commitment to this concept, San Francisco Theological Seminary actually brought in a game designer and futurist to help launch their theological center. So let me break that down for you just a little bit. We Presbyterians, we're sometimes lovingly referred to as the frozen chosen. A seminary rooted in Presbyterianism brought in a gamer to talk to us about how the church can learn new tools from gaming. If we, as a church, hope to move forward and to continue to have a positive impact on the community where we reside, I believe that we're going to have to find new tools. We have to first define the issues that we're trying to deal with, then look to people who have already created tools for addressing those issues. They may be people in unexpected places, or they may be people sitting right next to us in our pews. It's hard to say exactly what the tools are that we're going to need until we have decided what the issues we need to address are. But the key is our willingness to try something new, to indeed trust that God is doing a new thing, and to willingly, and dare I say, enthusiastically, try new things in an effort to share love with each other, with the community around us, and even with the world. Bible verse or the message I gave or share your thoughts on the general topic. We're still needing to kill a lot of time, so I'm really hoping you are talkative today. Are there those who like to share the limb in the back?
Before I go up, I wanted to help solve your weight problem. This is in line with something that was apparently done by a presidential candidate. You just report your height as 2 or 3 inches taller than you are, and the weight problem
works
goes away.
Just fine.
Your BMI is good.
Mark, thank you.
Yeah.
As you were sharing your sermon, I had an experience this week. Our son Will went to work down east to help through his hospital with a temporary hospital that was set up in a community, which was a church that was built after the flood, maybe 10 years ago, to just serve as this kind of headquarters for emergencies when there was needing. But the point of the story is that Will came to church every Sunday that he lived at home on Saturday night until he left home. But he doesn't go to church now. And as I share with my friends, some in this church, a lot of other young adults are in the same way, that they grew up in the church but do not go to church. But the point that was so important to me. Every time I talked with him for the 8 days that he was down there, he talked about what a great group of women, and he didn't get to know many of the men, but some of who prepared food for those persons. And his whole attitude changed about the church. Now, you know, I doubt that he starts going to church because he's doing other things. He works on Saturday and Sunday, and that's a good excuse. But anyway, the point was he shared one story that they had breakfast and you were supposed to have eaten by 8 o'clock. And about 9 o'clock, 25 people who were military police came in. He said they went back to the kitchen, prepared a meal for 25 persons, and not one of them complained.
Mark, thank you for what you said today, and I appreciate it. And again, it made me think about a lot of different things. The name of the sermon was What the Church Needs. And I just want to ask a question. Does the church have a clear purpose? And if it does, what is that purpose? And are we striving to accomplish whatever our purpose is? You know, a football team's supposed to win the game.
Right.
A shoemaker is supposed to fix the shoes. What's the church supposed to do? And how do we do it? And as you said, you need to get some people that know what the heck they're talking about.
That's right.
Not you, Mark. You do a pretty good job. We'll give you an A+ on that sermon.
Fair enough. that's actually, you know, a difficult question. It's easier to answer the question if church has a little C. Like, what is our church's purpose? Because the process we're going through, like what we do today, is leading us to that point of what do we say our church's purpose is. So we're getting there on the little C. The problem is the church with the big C, the church collective, has so many varying interpretations of what we're supposed to be doing because the holy scriptures that we use give us a number of different very viable reasons that we're supposed to be. I would narrow it down to the ultimate thing is that we're supposed to share God's love. And you can, I like to oversimplify things, but that's the point, is that we're supposed to share God's love. The rest of it will take care of itself if we're actively doing that. There's others who would say it's to win souls to Christ. There's others who would say, there's churches that would say it's to help the community that we live in. So it's difficult to say precisely what it is for the overall church, but that's exactly the task that we're working on about our church. Who are we and what do we feel like our purpose is? So it's a great question because it's important for us to define that, like you were saying.
Good morning, I'm Morgan. Thanks, Mark, for your message. As I was reflecting on this, I realized that the predicament that both the little church and the big church is quite complicated. But you know, I guess what really stands out for me is the fact that. Well, there's a quote from Brian Swim where he says something like, when you work outside the creativity of the universe, exhaustion results. And I think for a long time, the church has been working outside the creativity of the universe. I think we know too much. I think we think we've got it figured out and we're not listening for a fresh vision or revelation. And that revelation can be so counterintuitive to what we're used to thinking about and proclaiming that we just want to reject it right away. I think there just needs to be a lot of listening, a lot of radical simplification, and really listening to what the earth and the cosmos are saying. I mean, the earth is crying out for a lot of change, and I think we're just too frenzied, rushed, think we know it all, and we're not willing to really listen and see and what the earth is saying and reject those things that may have been perfectly fine, perfectly applicable in a previous era and may have won souls and made people's lives better and all that. But right now, it is done. And young people do not want to hear that. There's a process of unlearning, decolonization, all that that's happening in our culture. And Christianity is still very much wed and tied up in that the Western imperial, all that stuff. And people are like, I don't want to hear it. So I think we just need to really, you know, how radical are we willing to go? I mean, we're willing, if we're still committed to, say, weekly church service, for example, I mean, that's a very core foundational practice. But so far, things like that have been off limits in terms of what we're willing to consider to do differently. So I think that's, there's still a lot of conversation and listening that needs to happen around that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you, Mark, for the focus on innovation, which I think can certainly make a difference. I'm wondering if there is impetus to look at that as a practice for this church, and if so, what are the steps we might take in order to get that started?
I hope that there is, and that's part of what this process will be doing, is we're going to collectively decide if that's part of it. It's part of why I gave this message, just to put it out there. I genuinely do think that if churches want to survive, both little C and big C, that having an impetus for that is essential.
May I add one more comment?
Sure.
It could be very helpful to us, I think, to give examples of best practices. Mm. What are some churches that are doing this, or communities that are coming together and having a different kind of focus?
Just an example. I'm not saying this is what we should do, but some of the most successful churches right now, one, they do tend to be new upstarts, although sometimes they're churches who just decide that they're going to do something different, are churches that don't meet in churches anymore. In particular, bars. That has become a very big thing where people gather. They may have a glass of wine, and they do studies, and they have someone give a talk. And but that kind of thing, being willing to go outside of the normal confines and anything like that. There's also churches who don't have worship services anymore. There's churches that don't really have a hierarchy anymore. They're all kind of it's based on whose gifts are where, and each person takes the lead when what they're doing goes that way. Those are just off the top of my head, but I mean, there's example after example, and frankly, ultimately they tend to be successful. Now, what they do though is they're willing to risk loss. They're willing to not get it right. They're willing to say, sounds interesting, why don't we try? Even if it's going to fail, and they don't see failure as, well, we messed that up. It's just like, well, now we know how not to do it. What can we do next? And so, yeah, I think that that's a key for sure, is that you're willing to try almost whatever. As long as the core is whatever our community says is who we are, if our community says we're a community that's about love, then as long as the core of what we do is about that, then we should be willing to try things that fit around it, as long as we're rooting ourselves in that. And be willing to possibly fail. I mean, too frequently, I've been in lots of meetings with churches, because sometimes I go to churches and help them think through things and about what they could do. And almost without fail, there's always a core group of people whose essential response when a great, interesting, different idea comes up is, oh, but, you know, what if it doesn't work out? And that, oddly, almost always shuts the discussion down. You know, we have to get away from that if we really do want something different than what we have now. I don't remember exactly who the quote comes from, but the whole idea of you can't keep doing over and over again what you've been doing and expect different results. It's been credited to Einstein, but I think it was someone else who actually said it. But we've got to break past that idea of somehow that we can keep doing what we're doing, mostly like we're doing, and get really fantastically different results. We're not. We're going to get the same result. Churches have been doing it for decades now, getting the same results. Lots more. One right behind you, actually. Might save you some steps.
Hi, I'm Anthony. A year or two ago, I was studying this question a lot. I was reading a lot online all the time, and one of the things that I have been reluctant to say at this point, but I'm willing to say, as Mark is kind of calling us into crisis, is that one of the areas I think that I found innovative thinking was from the atheist community. Mm. And I want to be clear about, you know, the atheist community, that what I'm talking about, these are people of high moral and ethical principled standards. It's not, I just want to challenge you, if you're kind of thinking atheist equals anarchist, this is not the kind of person I'm talking about. And there's plenty of people like this on the, is it Pathos? How do you say
Pathos?
Pathos blog. And some of them especially talked about wanting a community and not having one to go to, but they want it. Mm-hmm. And so to hear that group articulate what kind of community they want might give the church some clues. Mm-hmm. I think that some of those people seek community or activity through, or, you know, seek other people through social justice kind of activities. And because that gives them a sense of purpose and connection with a real deep Absolutely. Connection with those people. But that, I think that's one place that we could actually look. And it doesn't mean we would take the theism out of this community. It would, it's understanding what, in our today's world, what kind of community people want.
Just to piggyback on that a little bit, I believe it's at Harvard they have an atheist campus minister. And he's being very successful at attracting young folks. And a lot of it is around social justice issues. So I think that there's a lot. One of my good friends that I actually toured a little bit with is a former minister who became an atheist, and he and I would have what we called common ground conversations. He actually started one of the first intentional communities for atheists, and it's in an old church. But they went through this process, and they're attracting a lot of 20- and 30-year-olds. So I agree with you. I think it's certainly a source to look at. Others. I know there were lots more hands.
Excuse me. My name is Zora, and Mark, well, you mentioned a word which described the type of church that this entire church entity is, the Savior Church. Mm. Well, the Savior Church refers to a seed idea, and you really majored in philosophy, so examining seed ideas is really important, because out of that springs existence of structures and ideas and organizations. So the seed idea of this Savior Church is a Savior that would come along and make everything better for everybody. Abdication of responsibility, submission to authority, all the Abrahamic religions are this way. But we live in a time now where every single individual can, at the press of a button, at the, working out of their own lives, has ultimate power to create the kind of dwelling they want to live in, the kind of work they want to have, and really ultimate self-responsibility. And, of course, because we are souls, we do care about other beings around us who are having a difficult time with that, and we want to do something about it. But here we have a huge entity that teaches us, give it all over to God. It's like, why do we have hands and minds? Why do we say to ourselves, well, we can create what we need to create in our lives. We can do it for our friends. We can do it for our community. But yet we're supposed to abdicate responsibility and give it all up. And I think that is related to this whole loss of interest, especially among the young, who have come in, and their young soul, they're actually old souls that have a lot of wisdom, and they're coming in, and they're told, oh, give it all over to God. And yet they're also being taught, here, you can create whatever you need to create in your life. So I'm just.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Are there others? Right here.
Good morning. My name is Jim. I have not been here very much recently, as some of you may know. And I came today because I think this is an important thing. And I've been a part of this church for a pretty good while. And I wrote some notes that I want to share with you. And that is, we talk about the dying church or whatever. We focus on our own needs when we say that. And we continue to focus on the church. What we do in the church is so fundamentally important. But I believe that we need to think outside the church and spend more time thinking about who we are in the community and how we create a better place in terms of housing, in terms of poverty, in terms of racism. And the other thing we do is we have a tendency, I think, to say, I want it my way. And that, again, focuses the on ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that until we figure out that we find ourselves by focusing on others, we're not going anywhere.
Great point. That's a great point. We got one last here for Kelly. And by the way, y'all did an excellent job. Now we're going to have to hurry so we're down there on time. So for all of y'all, well done.
Hey, I'm Kelly. The one of the Sunday school classes is studying the recent writings of Bishop Spong, who talks about reformation. And what he seems to be doing is dismantling Christianity, and then with the challenge of putting it back together. So just speaking for myself, one of the challenges I face in a Christian church like this one is once you dismantle Christianity the way he's doing it, what's left? What aspects of Christianity are meaningful to me? And as we think about that together, where do we go with what we find is important? So it seems to me that's central for a Christian organization. I think, you know, when Mark is talking about the church, whether it's the little church or the big church, you're still dealing with Christianity. So what aspects of Christianity are meaning for me, speak for myself, and then what, as a group, do we find meaningful? Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.